Day by day, hour by hour, the conflict in the Middle East worsens.
A short time ago, the U.S. military carried out massive precision strikes on the three key nuclear facilities in the Iranian regime.
War leaders trade insults and threats as innocent people cower in basements.
Iran is under a war of aggression, unprovoked aggression first by Israel and now by the United States.
For years, your supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, has publicly and repeatedly called for the destruction of Israel and the United States. Israel acted as a last resort.
Europe calls for de-escalation. But is anyone listening?
Our foremost priority must now be to support de-escalation.
Those involved should de-escalate. Diplomacy and dialogue is the only way forward.
And while Israel and Iran continue to trade blows, we all hold our breath. It's News Talk Daily. I'm Ciara Doherty. And today we're asking, how are Iranians who live here in Ireland reacting to the ever-worsening situation in their home country? And what, if anything, can Europe's leaders do in response to this war? In a couple of minutes, I'll speak to an Irish-Iranian woman who has first-hand experience of what armed conflict and enforced exile means for ordinary people caught up in the crossfire. But first, let's get some analysis from Shona Murray, who is, of course, the European Affairs Correspondent at Euronews and, of course, a former foreign correspondent here at Newstalk. Hi, Shona.
Hi, Ciara. How are you doing?
I am wondering what the mood is like in European institutions today. We have this fairly nightmarish scenario playing out now in the Middle East with the United States inserting itself into a war between these mortal enemies, Israel and Iran. Mm. What are they thinking? What are they preparing for?
This all did come as a bit of a surprise because you have to remember just a few days before Donald Trump bombed Iran, the EU's chief foreign policy officer, Kaya Kallas, had met in Geneva with the UK, Germany and France to discuss with their Iranian counterpart how they would get back onto the negotiating table and really have diplomacy being key here. And then 2 days later, out of surprise, Donald Trump has bombed Iran, means the Europeans were out of the loop, meaning that Europe just feels a little bit at sea, that it doesn't really have any influence here. And if you have to go back to 2015, when we had the JCPOA, the Iran deal, the original Iran deal that was designed to take Iran out of being, I suppose, a rogue state and having its nuclear enrichment managed, Europe was really pivotal then. But then when Donald Trump unilaterally removed the US from it in 2017, it was no more. And now Europe really hasn't had any influence. And so this is a real problem.
Are European leaders scratching their heads, given the fact that Donald Trump ran as an anti-war candidate? Or is this just more of what they have grown used to with Donald Trump in presidency? Says one thing, does the absolute opposite.
I think they are scratching their heads because there was some recognition that maybe Donald Trump, because of MAGA's lack of support for foreign wars and for, as we heard, Donald Trump very much leading his campaign on removing the US from this theatre, that he's there bombing Iran, you know, is a bit of a shock. But then again, we know that Israel has been pushing for the United States to go after Iran and to support Israel in its attacks on Iran, that maybe Donald Trump could be moved in that direction. And we see that's the case. There's also a recognition that Donald Trump will be sort of at somewhat at pains to try to speak to his audience and say, look, this is only going to be short term. It's a number of specific surgical strikes. It's not all out war, not boots on the ground.
But when you're looking at the commentary, particularly over the weekend, I suppose on Sunday, from European leaders, other than the usual suspects, for example, the Czech Republic, those European leaders, they really didn't take a position. They didn't condone or they didn't condemn what Israel did or indeed America's involvement. It was all about de-escalation, diplomacy, step back from the brink. Do they really struggle to find a position here? Are they actually really quite impotent when it comes to issues in the Middle East, Shona?
Yeah, I mean, well, first of all, the G7 just beforehand did say that Israel, in the context of these strikes in Iran, had a right to defend itself, which is an implicit support of what Israel had done. Now, the EU itself doesn't hold that position because there's 27 countries and only around 15 of those countries agreed that Israel had a right to strike Iran. So the official EU position is somewhat more nuanced. It is that de-escalation and negotiations are key. And because there are some countries like Ireland, for example, and others who are concerned that the Israeli strikes and the American strikes didn't meet the threshold, the legal threshold of self-defense in order to attack another country. So yes, there is an impotence there because the EU can't agree on anything. And it's the same when it comes to Israel. Despite the mounting evidence of violations against international humanitarian law, where you have leaders indicted at the International Criminal Court for extermination and starvation, the EU still can't criticize or agree that Israel should be in any way sanctioned for its role in Gaza. So you're right. Impotence is actually, you know, an unfortunate but correct way of describing the situation.
The worsening conflict that we're looking at in the Middle East is going to put further economic pressure, isn't it, on us at a time when we still have, obviously not chronic inflation, but prices still significantly higher than they were before this bout of inflation took hold. Oil prices, you know, beginning to rise again. That's going to have all the capitals, including Dublin here, really worried, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, the oil price has actually been the key thing that I've heard from EU diplomats and people close to, let's say, the likes of Ursula von der Leyen, that that's the real concern over any fighting in the Middle East, particularly in countries like Iran, that the oil price would go up. And then you would have a situation comparable, they fear, to when Russia first did its full-scale invasion of Ukraine, when energy prices shot up because so many countries immediately were sanctioning Russia and they couldn't get cheap oil and gas anymore. It doesn't seem to be having the same impact in any way, but that doesn't mean it won't. We don't know how Iran will respond. Will it continue to be strongly related to Russia? Will China, will they all sort of group together? And we don't know how Donald Trump is going to, how far he's going to go with this either. Will he just sort of relent now and listen to maybe his base and say, well, I don't want to exacerbate the situation even further. It really is all to play for.
I'm just wondering, Shona, as somebody who walks the corridors of those European institutions day in, day out, what is being said over the water cooler about Donald Trump's attitude to Europe? The fact that he seems to have no respect for them.
Maybe they don't want to say a lot of it out loud. But there is a real problem in getting to an acknowledgement from senior EU diplomats about how bad the situation is in the United States. But the hostility from Donald Trump is really something like we've never seen before. When it comes to trade, when it comes to tariffs, but also trying to dismantle things like regulations when it comes to the tech industries. The United States is no ally of the EU right now. And I think a lot of people are only really starting to consider admitting that at the moment. And then crucially, you see, the EU is stuck because the United States has done so much to support Ukraine over the past 3 years. And the EU needs the United States to stay in NATO to protect European security for the next few decades. So that's really very critical and very, very delicate for the European Union to criticise Trump right now.
Yeah, not happening anytime soon. The whole world's in a state of chassis, eh, Shona? That's what it feels like at the minute.
It is, Kira. And nobody knows where it's going to go from here. But best of luck with the new podcast. Congratulations.
Thanks, Shona. I'm joined now by an Iranian woman who witnessed firsthand life inside the Islamic Republic, lost her father during the Iran-Iraq war, and has since made her life here in Ireland. Ruja Fazahidi is a professor of law and Islamic studies at the University of Galway, and she's also the chairperson of the Immigrant Council of Ireland. Ruja, thanks for joining us on News Talk Daily.
Thank you for having me, Kira.
Ruja, let's start, I suppose, with what it is like to be here in Ireland and to see missiles rain down on the country where you were born, where you spent the first 12 years of your life, where you would still have connections and family. What does that feel like?
It's very difficult to watch this war unfold. Like everyone I've talked to so far, both friends outside but also inside of Iran, there's a feeling of shock, sadness, anger, there's this mixture of anger towards Israel, obviously, but even more so towards the Islamic Republic and its leadership. You know, seeing basically people being caught in between what I call myself these two immoral states. They have no regards for human rights and human life, more so, and international law. You know, you feel almost you can't do much. I hear this as well from other friends, is what can we do? We are sitting here, we are just watching it unfold. And people who are in Iran as well, they don't know what's going to come next, especially as the bombings spread throughout Iran. Like people inside of Tehran, they've been trying to, some of them at least, to exit Tehran because they feel particularly unsafe. But then we see that the bombings are spreading. No one knows what's going to come next. Like within Iran, people don't know. There are no warnings, no sirens coming from the Iranian government side. There's no provisions for people to shelter during the Israeli attacks. And then from the Israeli side, there are IDF warnings, but with very, very little time telling people to move. It causes a lot of panic. Internet has been down for most of the days of the conflict so far. So even if there are certain warnings, you know, people probably don't have access or they come really late at night. So yeah, watching all of these from Ireland, where, you know, I'm sitting here safe, is quite difficult to do.
So to be clear, no air raid sirens, no public shelters for ordinary civilians. It sounds like the Islamic Republic, despite the fact that they have been on the brink of war for such a long period of time, they had no plan whatsoever to protect ordinary, innocent citizens.
Yes, and, you know, this goes back to the way they have ruled since 1979, that, you know, as I said before, there is a disregard for human life. There is a disregard for the well-being of the people. And, you know, and this really is shown now how there is no warning with, you know, with internet, no communication. They are trying to downplay it almost. Like we are hearing about the bombings in international media. We hear about death on both sides, but we are not hearing about the individuals being killed, the civilians being killed. They're at the moment, they're only a number. And part of this, again, as you said, comes back to questions of how prepared were they, even though they've been threatening Israel for God knows how long, saying that we are going to wipe Israel off the face of the map.
Tell me about life within Iran prior to this particular conflict. I mean, what is reality for people on a day-to-day basis? What is life like?
From what I hear from family and I hear from friends, you know, like anywhere else people want to live. So Iran is a beautiful country and very educated people. And in a way as well, like, you know, sometimes we think of Iran as quite separate from the rest of the world in a way because of the way that the state controls everything. But again, like, you know, we live in a very globalized world. So, for example, we all saw the 2022 Woman Life Freedom Movement and how young women went onto the streets and protested for their bodily autonomy and the choice not to wear the headscarf, and protested against general repression of the Islamic State. So you have, you know, you have people who want obviously to live and they live their day-to-day life, but there has been a widespread discontent with the Islamic State as well.
Yeah, I'm just fascinated to hear what it is like to live within a country where so many people are against the people who run and control that country, and to be stuck with that and to not have any choice or any freedom to be able to change that. What is that like? What does that do to your head space? What does that do to your mental health?
So again, it's difficult, and this is what you see now kind of in Iran as well, because people are divided in how reacting both in Iran and outside of Iran to these bombings, because there is a part of the population who are saying, oh, good, Israel is coming to bomb and they're going to get rid of this rulership. Whereas there are others who are saying, you know, obviously we are against the Islamic State, but this is no way, we don't want war. This is no way that we want a regime change. You know, any regime change should come from movements from within. Like if you look at kind of Iran's history after 1979 revolution, there has been widespread protests against the government from within. I'll go from the 1990s. So from like 1999, you had the widespread student protests in Iran. And then 2009 was the Green Movement, which was basically after the 2009 presidential elections. And then after that, there were a number of, again, widespread protests, 2017, 2018. These were more around economic situation in Iran. And 2018, I think, was the one on the rise of the fuel prices. And then you had the 2022, the more feminist protests, the Zan Zendegi Azadi, Woman Life Freedom movements. But it has been really difficult, for example, for minorities, religious minorities, for example, the Baha'is, the Sunni Muslims, that would be the Arab minority, the Kurdish minorities in Iran. There has been always widespread repression of any of these protests. Widespread arrest of activists, so a number of women's rights activists, environmental activists who've been in prison in the last, you know, since the Islamic Republic has come to power is huge. Apparently, there is a list of more people who've been listed as possible spies. So we are very worried about prisoners who have been accused of spying.
I know, for example, that you've been trying to find your friend's brother who's gone missing from a prison in which he was being held. Tell me about that.
Yes, so a friend of ours here in Ireland, Aida Younesi's brother, Ali Younesi, brilliant university student. He received the 2018 gold medal at the International Astronomy and Astrophysics Olympiad, was arrested in 2020 and has been serving a prison sentence. And a few days ago, he basically was taken from his cell in Evin, and they were told that they're just going to take him for interrogation and bring him back. And there's been absolutely no news of him. So obviously, friends and especially family are devastated and very, very worried. And we do hope that we get news from him soon.
And you, of course, Ruja, have real first-hand knowledge because your own father was killed then when you were just so young, 3 years of age.
Yes, absolutely. I do actually remember it because I was born in the war, the first year of the war. You'll all know how old I am now, 1980, and you know, and it was 8 year of war. Yes, my own father died during the war. You know, growing up, we grew up as martyrs, so-called martyrs' children. But my father was opposition, so he was part of one of the leftist movements, the Tudeh party. He was a medical doctor, so he was sent to area of Iran, Sardasht, which is very close to the Iraq border. Basically, he was shot, but it's not quite clear whether he was shot from this side or that side. But yes, so I grew up with my mom, you know, in a very patriarchal society at the time, and my mom was quite young. So I saw firsthand, you know, how she had to fight as a woman in this society. But also, I have memories of shortage of, for example, bread, fuel, and so on. Some of the things that we are starting to see now, people queuing for fuel, for bread. I have this very vivid memory of my grandmother asking me to go to the bakery. I was probably 6 or 7, and I went to the bakery and I queued for a long time. And when it got to me, he said no bread, and I just threw the money down and I started bawling my eyes. And I think he felt sorry for me, the baker. So he just said, little miss, come back. And he gave me a few, what we call lavash bread. So I do have that memory, and I think so do a lot of people around my age and older. That trauma of war is there with many people still in Iran.
I was just going to come to that, because there is this idea sometimes, oh, thank God these people are surviving the missiles, but we do forget about the psychological trauma of having lived through this experience. And also, what I'm wondering is this something that you have, Ruja, particularly now being here in Ireland and seeing what's happening in Iran, kind of a survivor's guilt that you're not there, that you didn't remain, that you're not with your family and with friends, you know, to support them through this time. You're here, you're safe in Ireland.
Definitely, I feel the need, a duty to do something. Or we are thinking right now with friends, how do we get aid to Iran if it comes to it? As you know, there's some very heavy sanctions on the Iranian state. And if it comes to it that the war does extend beyond a few weeks, there will be some need for humanitarian assistance. And how are we going to get all of that in? At the moment, there are friends and family who have no access to money because some of the banks have been hacked. At least we think they're hacked, but they don't have access to the banks physically. They're closed, and the bank machines, they don't have any money. They don't have access to the internet at the moment. For me, I want to do something practical. But using kind of the guilt language, I have heard many friends say that.
You mentioned there, Ruja, that, you know, you were seen as the child of a martyr, and that's how you were identified for years. I'm wondering then how it is to watch it being described on, you know, news reports and analysis around the world as being, you know, at the heart of some of the problems and the instability in the region, and to see your country being described, as I saw it last night in the news, as the head of the snake. That's how Israel described it. How does that sit?
It's just, you know, it's rich coming from Israel with everything that this Israeli leadership has been doing. I don't want to, you see, I think one thing we need to really be careful about is talking about the leadership, the government, the state versus the actual country and its people. So when I say that Iran is a beautiful country, beautiful people, you know, people who want to live their daily lives, those are the people. But the state itself is, you know, I think deserves every single criticism. Now, coming from Israel is what is it, the pot calling the kettle black? Because, you know, we've all seen what Israel has done in Gaza, what is still doing in Gaza and West Bank with all the killings, the genocide that's happening. So, you know, I think we do need to criticize both states, but also be aware that there are people that live there who don't want war, who just want to live their daily lives, both in Iran and in Israel, and that they really are caught between these two warmongering states.
Ruja Fezzahidi, thank you so much for taking the time to speak to us on News Talk Daily, and I hope your family stay well and safe.
Thank you so much, Kira.
Well, that's it from News Talk Daily with me, Kira Doherty. We'll be back again tomorrow with another edition. You'll find us, as always, on the Go Loud app or wherever you get your podcasts. Until then, goodbye.